Welcome to Farced Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
That's Pete.
I'm Pete.
And I'm Ben, his co-host on The Henson Perspective, where once again, we look back 45 years into the past to discuss the original American air date of an episode of The Muppet Show. On January 31st, 1977, Muppet Show hosted Vincent Price as its special guest star. The episode had been recorded slightly earlier, on October 19th through the 21st of 76. But now that it is the end of November...
It's the end of November? Where?
End of January.
Yeah.
They bring us an episode where they reference the end of December. So it's a great chronologically piece of weirdness.
Well, this aired in the UK even later than that.
Really?
It aired April 23rd.
So their New Year's Eve joke was even more badly timed. At least here it's the 31st of something.
Yeah.
But it was still very strange to have an end of the year joke be the culmination of a sketch.
Well, that makes sense considering the Jack Parnell-ness of it. But yeah, it's wild that they filmed a spooky episode with a spooky guest.
In October.
When
they could have dropped it 2 weeks later.
Yeah. And had it be on theme, and we're just like, no, we'll just put this wherever. Like, that's the 70s for you versus, like, today's television,
right,
where they plan that
you
stuff ahead.
You have themed programming to the T,
and
major American holidays, major American sitcoms always have a calendar-specific episode for Halloween, Thanksgiving, and Christmas.
Yeah, and that very well may have been happening in sitcoms at this time. Mm. I don't know. I don't remember. I was not alive. But yeah, the Muppets did not care. They were just like, yeah, we'll write what we want to write and air it when we want to air it.
The trivia track on the first season DVD is eager to point out that this is the first production episode where everything relates to the guest star. That the backstage and the guest star bits are all intertwined, and that in general, the theme is apparent. We talked about how that was, we first see that in broadcast order in the Valerie Harper episode, but this is the first time where after they came back from the holidays, they've made a number of changes. They altered the puppets on several puppets, the Blue Frackle, Sam the Eagle, and Janice have all been reconstructed.
Yep.
We've been talking about this all season, going back and forth about it. This doesn't really have a theme, the B-plot's disconnected. I assume we're not even going to need to talk about this next season because it will be so predictable. It's only in its absence that we're noticing.
Yeah. In the first part of the first season, it is truly a variety show where it then transforms into more of a sketch show in later seasons.
But I think this episode particularly has a couple of moments that are harbingers of things to come that become typical go-to aspects of the Muppet Show, and I think while this may or may not be elegant in its execution of it, it's clear that this is formative in terms of what the Muppet Show turns into for the next 4 years.
Yeah, this is certainly the first episode where they had that foresight.
Not Bruce Forsyth.
No, that was a few episodes ago. But the episode opens with Kermit introducing Vincent Price and giving a spooky ooh after saying his name, setting the tone right up top.
Fozzie has a vampire joke. So again, all of the, even the drop-in stuff, they're now saying, well, let's have this be on theme as well.
And then Gonzo, not quite on theme, he just shoots the O with a musket and leaves a slight soot mark on it. Also, according to the Wikia, we'll see this intro again.
Huh.
So, eagle-eyed viewers, keep your eyes peeled on production episode 24. Spoilers. Kermit appears before the Red Curtain, preparing us for a weird, strange, scary show. He warns us that this episode won't be filled with the usual jokes and japes, but then Fozzie enters and hits him in the face with a pie.
And Jim Henson trying to scrape the pie off of Kermit's face with a piece of felt attached to a wire is fun to watch for a second and a half, because you know that that hand is not really built for manipulation.
Yeah, unless it catches the pan just of perfectly. The pie. Right. It's not going to do anything.
And eventually Kermit just shakes his head until the pie pan falls off.
It's very good. Kermit then introduces the first act, which is a song, Under My Skin.
I've Got You Under My Skin by Cole Porter. The trivia track wants to point out that this is very clearly an adaptation of a specific version of the song that Stan Freberg did, and that there is a Sam and Friends antecedent for this performance.
I've got you.
You've got me.
Under my skin.
Under your skin.
I really like this. It's Behemoth and Shaky Sanchez singing.
So, Shaky Sanchez is named on the Wikia, and in the trivia track it's pointed out that he is called Shaky Sanchez. This puppet is two episodes old at this point. He was in the Avery Schreiber. That was his first appearance. Does not actually get referred to as Shaky Sanchez until season 5.
Wow.
But will appear sporadically as just sort of a nervous parrot between then and now. And is very clearly, in this episode, shaky, like nervous and jittery. But in this sketch, he's performed by Jim Henson.
Yep.
Every time we see him after this, he's interacting with Kermit. So the reason why he's shaky and speechless is because Jim Henson can't perform against Jim Henson.
But the reason why he's shaky in those other moments is immediately Behemoth eats him and sings the song with Shaky inside of him, mm-hmm. under his skin.
And Shaky periodically popping out of first the Behemoth's enormous wide mouth, which allows him to still be alive and undigested and visible in the camera. And then at one point popping out through a hole in the Behemoth's shoulder.
Yeah, that's weird.
It looked visibly uncomfortable when I said that phrase.
I didn't like it.
Thinking about the actual physicality of something popping out. Pete, never watch How to Get Ahead in Advertising.
Okay. I won't ask any follow-up questions.
Yes, no.
And, at least 4 times during this sketch, Shaky is removed from his puppeteer's arm, mm-hmm. and then put in a different position and then has to be rearmed to then continue. It's really cool.
Yeah.
I really, really liked this.
Yes, extremely well done sketch, and the first of many consumptions that will happen over the course of this episode.
But this one was not the...
It's not one of the rules that Jim Henson had that he says, if you need to get out of a sketch, there are 3 funny ways to end it. You have a character revealed to be the same, another character in a wig, you have a character explode, or you have a character eat another character. But Shaky Sanchez gets eaten in the opening bars of this number.
Yep. So it does not qualify. Was not counted.
As well it shouldn't be, but there will be counts to come. Well done. And we'll return to that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, then we have...
Speaking of consuming, is this the Statler and Waldorf one where they talk about... Where they make a joke about consumption?
No, this is that pants.
The next one is the consumer board. We have...
No. That's 3.
There are a lot of Statler and Waldorf.
There really is. This was a weird episode because when I watched it the first time, I felt like there wasn't a lot in this episode. I felt like every sketch was long and so there wasn't that many. And then when I was rewatching it and taking notes, I was like, oh, there's a lot in this episode. It was a weird watching it twice in 24 hours, having it spin on me like that. So yeah, Statler and Waldorf are in the box. Mm-hmm. Statler says that the Under My Skin number scared the pants off him, and Waldorf questions whether or not he was ever wearing any pants. Simple.
And for any listeners who tuned into our last episode, we talked a little bit about a moment where a reaction shot from Statler was cut in a previous episode. Mm-hmm. We have a long reaction moment here of 2 men staring below the waist at 1 man, unclear as to whether he's clothed or unclothed while they're staring at it. I thought that that was an interesting juxtaposition.
It's not okay for pants to be on fire, but it is okay for 2 men to be looking at an unclothed man, potentially.
Potentially. And for the audience to see that.
Yeah. We cut to backstage.
Mm-hmm.
We get our first backstage segment where Scooter introduces a three-headed Muppet to Kermit.
Now, you had brought this up because this Muppet was referred to as Tom, Dick, and Harry in a previous episode, and you said the wiki had told you that we would return to this character, but in a slightly different fashion.
Yes, and here it is. Tom, Dick, and Harry want an act in tonight's show.
Well, it's not exactly a he.
Okay, who is she?
Well, it's not exactly a she.
Scooter, this rather severely limits the possibilities. Would you please explain yourself?
Well, it's sort of a they.
I have a note saying, this introduction comes from my now not great gender binary discussion.
Correct.
It could be worse.
It could be a lot worse. It's in fact worse later in this episode. But here with Scooter talking about it, they do a decent job of dodging a bullet.
Yeah, Kermit even uses singular they at one point. But the joke is still at the expense of the gender spectrum.
Right. It's so, at the expense of somebody thinking that there should just be a binary.
Yeah. But Kermit's frustration caps with a very good line about Scooter to the audience of, this gopher is about to be a gonfer. I very much enjoyed that.
I missed that entirely.
Oh, really? Yeah, he looks straight at the camera when he's, just before he yells. Mm.
This gopher is about to become a gonfer. Scooter, what are you talking about?
But it's also odd in the way in which he's therefore basically doing an aside to the audience at the expense of his employee. He's then going to treat the three-headed monster, or the triple threat, as it's sort of referred to in this episode, with complete and utter disdain in the very next moment. They introduce themselves, and then Kermit just walks on stage away from him. Does not say goodbye, does not dismiss them, does not say get out of here. Just nopes out of the conversation. In a very unprofessional way. We ended the previous episode talking about the fact that Kermit does not at all seem angry or dismayed at the fact that Crazy Harry has blown up an expensive prop of his potential future guest star.
Marvel the Magnificent.
Yes. And in this, he's being introduced to a potential guest on the show and just ignores them, blows them off, and walks away. Kermit is a bad professional.
Well, he's actively stage managing while the show is happening. This isn't exactly the right time to pitch another act for tonight's show.
Except, he leaves as if what he's about to do is go do what he normally does, which is introduce an act. Except the cut there is then Hilda is introducing the act.
Then, as we've discussed, there are things we don't see that are on stage.
But that
we
is...
don't know what was happening next.
Chronologically, that should have been Kermit walking away from them on stage, but instead, he doesn't do the intro. Hilda is already there. So he didn't need to leave that conversation in that direction with that kind of haste.
Yeah.
He was just being unprofessional.
Well, I have a different chronological issue to take up later in this episode.
Okay.
So apparently this episode is filled with chronology issues. But as you discussed, the next thing we see is Hilda on stage.
Where she says, in honor of her homeland, she's going to introduce... This is a big what from me. Where suddenly being revealed that Aaron Oscar's accent that she's been doing for Hilda this whole time is supposed to be Transylvanian?
I think it was just Eastern European originally, and then they decided, we'll make this the truth.
Despite the fact that I bet it will never come back.
Yeah, I don't. I believe in the Wikia it says this is the first and only reference to her homeland.
But she does a good job of talking and painting a word picture of the high and brooding hills of the house in horror, and then does a really great scream as a transition to the world's worst matte painting.
Yeah, it's bad.
The painting could be worse, but the, quote, special effect, unquote, lightning that goes on top of it definitely makes it feel worse in perspective.
Yeah. As everyone knows, I time things for this episode. This sketch, which we'll talk about more later, but we started now, so I'm just going to say this anyway.
Yeah.
I timed this sketch because, like I said, the first time I watched this, I thought this was, like, half the show. And I also timed the intro because, like you said, it seems to go on forever.
Mm.
And the intro is 15 seconds long on this map painting.
Interesting.
That's how long it takes to zoom in and watch that poorly animated
bolt of lightning be the exact same shape, which lightning never is, three times in a row.
And the metal grate open on the thing. Yeah, it's wild.
But as you say, that leads us into a Vincent Price sketch, so we will come back to it.
After that was the next Statler and Waldorf, where they compare Vincent Price to the scary actor Thudge McGurk. Great name.
Thudge?
Thudge.
I heard Spuds.
Nope. Thudge. T-H-U-D-G-E.
Okay. Now, is that confirmed by the wiki, or was that just the subtitles?
Both, yes.
Okay. Because there's an interesting error in the subtitles of the DVD to come.
Thudge McGurk. I'll never forget him. His last film was Phantom of the Soap Opera.
Yeah, after that, he went berserk.
Now, I have a memory of having watched this years ago and being dissatisfied with what happens in the following moment of Statler and Waldorf describing the ghost of Thudge McGurk and then the monster meeting their description perfectly appearing. That's not how ghosts work. If you're haunting something, you are a shade of yourself. But you don't magically turn into something vivid day glow with multiple eyes and horns and a collar. That's not a ghost.
Especially considering we've seen ghosts already in this episode. That's right. Just haven't talked about them
yet. That's right. But if you're haunting something, I want you to be spectral and not a demon.
However, I don't think they ever say he's dead. So he could be alive and haunting theaters around the world. He could be haunting around theaters.
Yeah.
It's a quibble.
I'm going to say anybody that Statler and Waldorf grew up watching is dead.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
But it does turn it around by having a very good joke in that the appearance of the three-eyed, purple-horned people-eater that shows up and scares Statler so much he jumps, leaps, falls out of the box. The conclusion joke is that Waldorf leans over the edge of the balcony and says, "Listen, while you're down there, can you bring back some popcorn?" And the spectral, not spectral, demonic form of Thudge gibbers, and he says, "With some butter." And I loved that button on it.
It was good. I liked everything about this. I had no issues with Thudge being solid.
Thudge is a very solid name.
Yeah.
It feels earthy, grungy.
Viscous.
Good word. We have another scared parrot bit.
Scared parrot bit?
We have another moment with Shaky Sanchez.
Oh, yeah. He wanders through again. Yeah.
Interacting silently with the person that voiced him previously.
Yeah, I just didn't even note that because he just kind of wanders by.
This is bringing us back to our backstage runner of Kermit interacting with the three-headed triple threat, Tom, Dick, and Harry.
He asks them what kind of act they do. Each head answers differently. They never agree with each other. The only time they do agree with is when he asks, "Have you ever been on television before?"
They all simultaneously express astonishment at the question.
And then have three different answers for whether they've ever been on television.
Yeah. And this is where it ends with the gender dynamic that is more problematic in modern eyes. When Kermit asks who is in charge...
I think you fellas have some problems. Which one of you is the leader?
He is.
She is.
In fact, they got lots of problems.
And the fact that there are lots of problems with Tom, Dick, and Harry is that Tom, Dick, and Harry has multiple genders.
See,
the laugh line of this is, "Oh, you're both a boy and a girl, ha ha ha."
See, I didn't take that as the joke.
The part of, in fact, they have lots of problems?
Yeah, it was the fact that they never agreed with each other on anything is what I thought it was.
That's nicer.
Yeah, I actually kind of liked the fact that Tom, Dick, and Harry
were multiple genders.
Yeah, so I was, in my modern take, was like, oh, good job.
It's voiced by...
Jerry Nelson is Tom, Dave Goles is Dick, and John Lovelady is Harry.
Thank you. That's who I was missing. In my reading, anyway, that was what the button was. Mm. Oh, you have multiple genders, even though you're all voiced by male people. That's what your problem is. Boy, you sure need to work that out.
I had a bigger problem with the first one than I did with the second one. But we're all allowed our problem.
We go from that to Sam introducing Wayne and Wanda.
Yeah, he doesn't like the rest of the show. It's too filled with monsters and spooky things that he does not approve of.
I liked his intro where he says, "If you're like me, and you certainly must be." I like that in Sam's heart, he believes that he is reaching to a moral majority of the audience, even though he's surrounded by people who don't meet his standards.
Mm-hmm. And he wants to entertain us with the very natural, the very normal Wayne and Wanda. So then they come on, sing a song.
They do the beginning of Bewitched, Bothered, and Bewildered by Rodgers and Hart. And as Wanda sings the first word, Bewitched, she explodes in a puff of magic, and her head is replaced by that of the rebuilt Blue Frackle. And Wayne is left to sing Bothered and Bewildered in a very bewildered tone of voice.
Then we have a panel discussion, so we will return to that later, because Vincent Price is featured.
Mm-hmm. And now we finally, because of more eating that will happen, return to the joke that I thought happened previously, where Waldorf says,
"This show should be reported to the Consumer Protection Agency."
Why?
The host was just consumed.
Good pun.
Yeah, liked it. And then Kermit appears in the box and says, "Don't count on it," because he apparently wasn't eaten.
Right. Now, this show is bending over backwards in order to show us that things that are eaten are still alive. Mm. That's why we have Shaky wandering around backstage traumatized, is because even though he's eaten by the behemoth in the first musical number, we need to see that he's still alive. Kermit is eaten in the previous sketch, we'll cover it, but instantly pops up in the box in a weird version of teleportation that only the Prestige could explain.
Or Sam the Eagle.
You'll notice another character in the previous sketch never reappears.
Yeah, very true.
So eating is mostly not fatal.
But Statler and Waldorf don't like that Kermit's in their box.
No.
And
they demand... know clearly he runs the theater, but still are asking him.
That it's their box, and they demand to see his ticket stub, which he doesn't have.
This follows At the Dance, where we have spooky combinations of dance pairs. We have George and Mildred as a regular couple, but everybody else is a new, creepy
yeah.
couple.
Or
starting,
ghosts.
Starting off with a pair of ghosts who repeats their, gets two jokes. The second joke is fantastic. Well, really, perhaps the best joke that At the Dance has done.
The first joke is just a walked into a bar joke. Two ghosts walk into a bar, the bartender says, "We don't serve spirits here."
I've never heard that particular walked into a bar joke.
Oh.
So maybe that's why I was more impressed with it.
Yeah, no, I like the first one more.
Interesting.
"I'm going into the moving business."
"Really? Locally?"
"No, ghost to ghost."
It was something I hadn't heard before.
Okay.
So hearing the other one, I was just like, okay, yes. Upon first hearing it, I groaned. But then hearing the second ghost pun, I went, I like the first one more, because that was original to me.
I suppose that is one of the things about what tends to be styled as dad jokes or cracker jokes, is they're either painfully obvious or deliberately wordplay without any actual comic undertones. Like, it's just word substitution and then sort of staring at you expectantly thinking, that's enough for a joke, right? Which is what the first one is.
Yeah.
The second one is a legitimately good setup and pun, but obviously ordinary enough that many people could have come up with it.
Yeah.
I just had never heard it before, and so I was impressed with the cleverness of it.
Well, I'm sad that this is the first time you've heard it, but also happy that you got so much joy out.
True enough.
The second one I also have an issue with, not the ghost, the second At the Dance partnership.
Yes.
So it's a woman dancing, and you can't see her partner at first.
His back is to the camera.
And she says, "I'm starving. Do you want to get a bite?" And then it's revealed that he's a vampire and he bites her neck. She's starving. She's getting eaten. That's not helping her hunger.
No.
It's helping his hunger.
No, Pete, this is about male selfishness.
She should have then said, "You look hungry. Do you want to get a bite?"
Mm.
Again, give me 45 years. I'll punch anything out.
I'm saying, I think this is just a standard masculine dynamic, is that she's expressing need and he's saying, "My need is more important than yours." That's on brand.
Yeah, I mean, I also...
I mean, did you look understand. At that vampire's goatee? He's clearly some sort of appalling bro vampire.
Yeah.
That vampire is voiced and performed by Jerry Nelson, who plays the Count Von Count on Sesame Street.
Ah.
But yeah, the trivia track pointed that out in a very weirdly formatted way, but I still appreciated that they were like, "Look, Nelson's doing two different kinds of vampires. That's fun." And I agree.
Going back to At the Dance,
mm-hmm.
Pogo George watch.
Mm.
He's pogoing.
Oh, he's very pogoing.
And then the last joke quote-unquote, from the segment is a joke they've done before.
That's right.
Two monsters saying...
My mother said I should get ahead.
And then the partner removes her head and hands it to him.
Pete, what did you think about the UK spot?
Hey, Ben, what did you think I thought about the UK spot?
Well, so let me describe it to our audience. Three ghosts perform I'm Looking Through You by the Beatles, which originally appeared on Rubber Soul in 1965. And it's basically a moving camera pan backstage with ghosts being shot on a blue screen superimposed on top of it. They bob up and down in the air, and a middle ghost sort of appears and disappears in between them. But the action is fairly limited. To appreciate this, you have to either appreciate the song or you have to know the lyrics well enough that you can see that they're doing clever things with relationship to the lyrics and the movement of the ghost. So, for example, there's a bit where the lyrics are, you have a nasty habit of disappearing overnight, and the middle female ghost vanishes as they sing that lyric. There's also one where they say, we're looking down on you, and she goes beneath them and says, hi, and waves up. So there is choreography that's done in relationship with the lyrics, but if you don't know the song, it's just sort of aimless movement on the screen.
Mm. Your lips are moving, I cannot hear. Your voice is soothing, but the words are clear.
Based on your hums and nods as I describe these things, I'm guessing you picked up on none of that and therefore hated this.
So similar to what I said earlier about the Vincent Price thing
that
we haven't talked about yet, feeling like it was half of the episode... I thought this was way longer than the allotted 2 minutes.
You thought it was interminable.
Yeah. Watching it a second time, I appreciate the camera movement. Like, it's fun seeing all the details of the backstage. I did like Fozzie's little segment.
Where he comes on, is scared by the ghost, and then comes back and in the last moments of the song, waves them away, shaking papers that they're trying to shoo them out of the studio.
Yeah. Enjoyed all of that. But when it was just ghosts on stage, I was like, this is interminable. And to find out it was only 2 minutes and 1 second shocked me. Oh, 1 minute, 58 seconds of music, and then 5 seconds of Fozzie shooing them.
Fozzie shooing. After the UK spot, the American audiences in 1977 would have come back from commercial to a talk spot between Kermit and Vincent Price. We will trip merrily by it and get to the Statler and Waldorf bit that followed, where we make a absent wife joke.
Mm-hmm. Statler thought Waldorf's wife was coming tonight. He says the old bat couldn't come, and then bats crash the box.
The old bat couldn't come.
Well, the rest of them sure made it.
Decent joke.
Yeah.
It's not great for Statler to be referring to his wife as an old bat, but a decent setup to... They love these bat puppets. They use them 5 times over the course of the episode.
Yeah, ghosts and bats get used all the time in this episode. But also, time-wise, 1977 seems like a period of time where people were still referring to wives as old bats. I feel like that was still in the culture and in the zeitgeist at that time.
It's very British in that I've always assumed old bat is short for old battle axe, which was probably not created by, but absolutely solidified by, the British comic strip Andy Capp.
I don't think I ever realized that was British.
Yep, the flat cap and the pints and the drinking, it's very British.
Yeah, that all makes sense now, but never...
Growing up seeing it in the newspaper, you just assumed it was...
Philadelphia, for some reason, is what comes into my mind.
I definitely want to now see Andy Capp added to the cast of It's Always Sunny.
Just the old guy at the bar that's constantly there.
100%. After Statler and Waldorf, we come back to the triple header, who is told that there's no place for them, but they really want to do their song for Kermit, which ends up being T for Three.
Yep.
It's such a bad joke that the writers decide to comment on it by having the ghosts show up and say, who writes this stuff anyway?
Who writes this stuff anyway?
Who else? The ghost writer.
Then we go to, however, the most ingenious Muppet Newsflash that we've ever seen. The most
definitely
involved.
One of, yes, involved is a great word. I was going to say technically complicated, because it starts, unlike every other Muppet Newsflash we've had so far, where we're in studio. We are the camera in the studio with the Muppet Newsman. We start with a frame around it, and we are watching a television that has, and in fact, the sound quality has changed. Yep. So it's not just Henson's voice doing the Muppet Newsman. It's through a filter, as if it's coming through television speakers. And the camera zooms out in order to show us the television in a person's home.
And as all this is happening, the newsman is talking about how furniture all over town has turned into monsters. As he's explaining this news story, the house that this television is in, all of the furniture is turning into monsters and chasing the owner around.
As the newsman ends the broadcast, the television turns off and the television turns into a monster, which then bites the head off the man. As it's doing that, we cut back to the studio where the newsman is poo-pooing his own story, saying this is ridiculous, and then his desk eats him. So it's a double button.
Yep.
The sketch ends twice, both times with somebody being eaten, which I thought was hilarious in that we knew that that was a thing that Henson thought was a funny way to end a sketch, and he crammed two of them into the same sketch. I was delighted.
Yeah, it was good.
The Trivia Jack points out that in season two, we're going to see that the running gag with the newsman is he'll be talking about a story, and the thing that will happen in the story will happen in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
The joke will be whatever he's reporting on attacks him. This is the first time that that happens. This is the game changer, the switcher of them saying, oh, you know what we should be doing in this is less weird cameos from the guest star where they come on and they do a very brief character moment, and that seems to be that this is the germ from which that emerges.
It'll be interesting because I feel like I enjoy the character bits, so I would like those to not go away all the time, but I definitely like remember those as classic Muppet moments, so I would like to see both.
I think the newsman ends up turning into more of a wipe.
Yeah.
And that's what that allows that to do that. As he rushes on, he reads the headline of something disastrous happened. End of sketch.
If Muppet Newsflash replaces Houses on the Streets, I would be forever grateful.
Well.
Which, yeah.
We have.
We're getting up.
We've got a backstage moment.
We have a Vincent Price blackout moment.
But then we have Fozzie with the triple head.
Yes. And Tom, Dick, and Harry tell Fozzie that they're now comedians. They're not going to do the song anymore. Now they want to be comedians.
Fozzie does not look at all threatened by this. Fozzie does not act in a way of like, wait, you're treading on my territory.
Until.
But they do describe what their premise is that no matter how bad we are, we'll always love us. And then proceed to demonstrate just how bad they can be by doing a very traditional, who was that lady I saw you with last night, which Fozzie should feel threatened by, because that's 100% the kind of dated shtick that he would do.
Yeah.
But the punchline is, that was no lady, that was a pawn shop sign. Seems nonsensical. The Trivia Track wants to explain it. They say that a pawn shop sign is traditionally three balls. I don't know why they think that's helpful.
Yeah, I don't know what it could mean.
I don't want to go there.
Yeah. But going back to before they tell that joke,
yeah.
They tell Fozzie that one is the comedian.
One is the straight man.
One is the straight man, and one is the audience.
Right. And so the audience head responds uproariously to this piece of nonsense that doesn't follow. And they're all very satisfied with the arrangement of they told a joke, it was bad, they all think they're great.
And I think it's the third head that Fozzie is jealous of. He wants a second head. He wants to be the comedian and have a second head that will laugh at everything that he says.
Right.
Then
we get to the street gang.
Yep.
Finally get to the houses. Pete.
The other two houses talk.
The camera pans
to the right
instead of to the left.
Yeah.
It's a brand new day.
It is.
No, it's not.
No, it's still a bad joke.
It's a joke they've done before.
They haven't done this joke before.
They've done this exact structure. Before it was, my son's very interested in religion. Oh, yeah. Is he? He's a church. Now they do,
my youngest boy is very interested in medicine.
Oh, he's a doctor.
No, a hospital.
It's the same joke.
But it's not the same joke. It's a different words. So the Wikia made a big point of this is the only non-themed
joke in the episode.
But I would wager that while the joke is not themed, the reason why they panned to the right instead is because the fourth house is very gothic looking. It's built with that style, so it looks like a spooky house. And so that's why they went over there.
I have a slightly different take. Please, I think that this episode, for whatever reason, focused on the voice talents of Aaron Oskar and of John Lovelady. They have more to do. We have a whole bunch of stuff by Aaron. She's the female ghost. Hilda gets a strong moment. She's the house in this sketch. You hear her voice, I think, more in this episode than we hear her contribute to the show, period. John Lovelady is doing the John Lennon bit in the ghost song. There's just, in general, an elevation of the two more minor Muppet performers. And they're minor to us in part because they don't continue on with the show. If they had participated in all five seasons, I think those names would ring out as much as Dave Goles's does. But I think there may have been something, either production-wise, where the main players couldn't fill in, or they were trying to create a greater role equity. All of this is speculation, but I think that that was probably something that was going on. Either they needed to be elevated for workflow, or they were like, guys, give us something to do.
Yeah, John Lovelady is only credited with two things in this episode, but one of them is Harry. So yep. He was in four sketches.
That's right.
Yeah, he's Harry and Ghost. So besides being the Lennon, he was probably in the other ghost dance. In the other things that we haven't talked about yet.
Yep.
Interesting.
There's also the reality. We talk a lot about the real estate of, well, if you cast this person, then somebody else has to do it. Because Tom, Dick, and Harry interact with Kermit and with Fozzie and with Scooter, you can't have Richard Hunt and Frank Oz be part of that group. Therefore, that has to be the three male players. Mm-hmm. And so that's why you have Nelson Goles and Lovelady filling that part out.
Very good point. But after the houses, we have Kermit introducing Vincent Price in a very Vincent Price-esque style.
Not on the season one DVD.
I know. You didn't get a whole segment.
Now, this is on the original Best of DVDs. Volume 5, which has Alice Cooper, Vincent Price, and Marty Feldman, which is a great, creepy trio. In that, you get the whole episode. But on the season one DVD, because of music rights issues, this episode is 22 minutes long and change, because they lose that whole segment. And so it goes from the houses to Vincent Price saying goodbye. Wow. And it feels like the worst denouement ever.
Wow.
Whereas when you plug that musical number back in, this has a great ending.
Yeah, I didn't think about that sharp twist in the episode.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also weird that this didn't clear, but the Beatles did.
I have a very little bit here about Tapestry, the 1971 album that Carole King released You've Got a Friend On, and that she got Grammy for Song of the Year for it, and that it was covered that same year by somebody else. I'm guessing there are antique rights issues that from that very first year in terms of who owns it, who therefore gets to control the licensing. Whereas legendarily, the Beatles catalog got bought by Michael Jackson and then bought by... So there have been various time periods in which people were willing to license Beatles music, eager to license Beatles music, in fact, depending on who was controlling it.
Expensive.
True.
So that's, I think, the reason why I'm shocked that the Beatles
somebody was
made
willing
it
to pay for it.
And not this, yeah.
Whereas I think whoever is controlling Carole King was just like, no. As opposed to, this is how much we're willing to pay. I think they were just flat out knowing it.
Yeah.
Obviously, do I know? Do I have the inside track as to the licensing of Carole King music? No, I do not.
Oh man, I should start keeping stats on the times we wildly speculate on these things. Because this would be another mark in that. I'm not gonna.
Let's not keep a record of how many times we're admitting that we're just making stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
Good call. But it will be fun to talk about that musical number in a moment. Yeah, so
Did you rewatch it?
While looking for an explanation of a joke that we'll get to, I found a recap column that pointed out the fact that this had been excised from the season one DVD and was real mad about it. So I took that opportunity of them linking to the YouTube video to watch it myself.
Fair. So you took the fun of me revealing away from me.
I'm sorry that research got in the way of you having an advantage over me.
Boo.
The episode, as I say, as far as I watched it, cut directly from the street gang to the outro, which we won't talk about entirely, except that the outro then leads to the final Statler and Waldorf joke, except it's not Statler, it's Sludge.
Fudge.
It's Fudge and Waldorf.
Yeah. And so this is my chronological issue.
Mm.
The Fudge section should have been the one previous
joke
to this.
Yep,
yes.
Because we had
two
Statler and Waldorf jokes in the middle where Statler should have been not back in the booth in order for this to have happened.
Yeah. Granted, it's a better surprise callback to have that space be there, but logically speaking... But yes, so Waldorf and Fudge are in the Spox. Fudge is speaking gibberish.
Well, that's easy for you to say.
Pete, that's a Laugh-In joke.
Yeah.
That's a 100% stolen by the Laugh-In writers who work on this show Laugh-In joke. And I'm here for it.
Oh, yeah. No, it's good. It's good. So, Ben, we've gone through the episode without talking too much about Vincent Price.
We've definitely bled, no pun intended, into the vampiric talents of Vincent Price.
But before we dive deeper into the Vincent Price segments, let's see what you know about what I find interesting about Vincent Price.
All right, so you're going to give me a little quizzy on Vinny.
Yes. I don't think he would appreciate you calling
him. Wow. Of all the nicknames that you've given our guest stars, you're not talking about Vincent Price as Vinny?
No. He's Vince, clearly. So question number one. Vincent Price graduated from Yale in the early 1930s as an art and English student. During his time there, he wrote papers with which of the following problematic views as a student?
Great.
A. Anti-Semitic, pro-Hitler. B. Anti-LGBTQIA+. Or C. Pro-eugenics.
Pro-eugenics.
Incorrect. Anti-Semitic, pro-Hitler.
Wow.
Yes. Vincent was raised by very conservative parents, but later in his life became friends with Dorothy Parker and Lillian Hellman in New York City, who helped turn him into a very outspoken liberal. But his anti-Semitic views initially graylisted him under McCarthyism, but he signed a secret oath with the FBI that gave him another shot at having a career.
That's wild.
Yeah. His daughter Victoria Price wrote about it in her biography of him. She's a lesbian, and he was very supportive of her when she came out, and he was very pro-LGBTQIA+ rights, even going so far to speak out against someone who was anti those rights in the 70s. Don't remember who she is. Question 2. Vincent Price has 7 works in the Library of Congress's National Film Registry. Which of the following is not one of his works in the registry? A. House of Wax from 1953, B. The Last Man on Earth from 1964, or Michael Jackson's Thriller music video from 1983.
I'm tempted to say the third one because it's not a feature, but it's notorious. Well included, then, as a thing to make me doubt everything. I'm going to stick with that. C.
Incorrect. It is The Last Man on Earth. His other works in the National Film Registry include Laura from 1944, Leave Her to Heaven from 1945, Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein from 1948.
The National Film Registry is wacky.
The Ten Commandments from 1956, and House of Usher from 1960. So question number 3, as an art student from Yale, he obviously loved art, and he opened the Vincent Price Art Museum in East Los Angeles in 1957. But which retailer did he work with as a, quote, art consultant who offered the, quote, Vincent Price collection of fine art from 1962 to 1971? JCPenney, Macy's, or Sears?
Macy's.
Incorrect. Sears Roebuck offered Vincent Price's collection of fine art. According to Wikipedia, he helped bring fine art to 50,000 people through this collection.
He's the William Morris of his day.
So, Vincent Price is clearly a horror icon, and so he was friends with other horror icons. So So for question number 4, which of the following was Vincent Price misidentified as by a woman on a plane 15 years after that star's death, and he pretended that he was that star and gave this woman an autograph? A. Bela Lugosi, B. Boris Karloff, or C. Lon Chaney?
Lugosi.
Incorrect. Boris Karloff.
Hmm.
However, I do have a fun fact about Vincent Bela Lugosi.
Yeah.
Vincent attended Bela Lugosi's funeral with Peter Lorre, and upon seeing that Lugosi was dressed as Dracula in the casket, remarked to Lorre, "Do you think we should drive a stake through his heart just in case?"
Okay. Question number 5.
Question number 5. As demonstrated in this episode, which we will talk about shortly, Vincent Price was a gourmet chef. He co-authored several cookbooks with his second wife, Mary. He hosted at least 2 cooking shows on the BBC, one in 1971 called Cooking Pricewise, and one in 1982, a 5-part series called A Taste of China. But on November 21st, 1975, Vincent appeared on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, where he demonstrated what non-traditional way to cook a meal. A. How to cook a steak on a car engine. B. How to cook rice in a washing machine. Or C. How to poach fish in a dishwasher.
Dishwasher.
Correct. I watched this clip on YouTube today. It was very fun. Vincent Price makes a very dirty joke about being married multiple times. So, this will help even the odds.
Mm-hmm.
Because you got 1 out of 5 correct. Which, considering last week I got 0 out of 5... did not really help even the odds.
What I was hoping you might research was that Price went through a reputationally fallow period. In general, there's a sense that Burton did wonders for him by including him as the voiceover in Vincent,
mm-hmm.
as the voiceover in, not the soundtrack, but in the film of Tim Burton's A Nightmare Before Christmas, and including him in Edward Scissorhands. That his worship of him helped bring him back to a degree of respectability, whereas he had been in a sort of schlocky camp vibe for a long time. And I think he does an excellent job of being camp in this. I think he's fun. I think he's with the ability to make jokes at his own expense in the way in which it took several decades, for example, for William Shatner to be able to get to that vibe. And Adam West, the same. Like, people of that era had a hard time acknowledging that the things that they'd done previously might have been a little goofy. Whereas Price is full-on goof in this, in great ways, in my opinion.
Hmm.
So I was interested as to whether or not perhaps this was part of a period where he might have gone too far, and therefore doing things like The Tonight Show, being on cooking programs, being silly, being almost John Waters-esque, might have hurt his reputation and standing, and that it took somebody like Burton to say, no, seriously, let's take this guy and praise him for what he did.
Yeah, I don't know. I clearly don't know much of, or haven't seen much of his other works.
Mm.
So I can't really say for certain. So I didn't really like Vincent Price in this.
Yeah, I'm noticing that.
Because with the exception of the talk spot, he was too on the nose.
Hmm.
Like, he was just Vincent Price. He was the epitome of what I expected him to be. And so I didn't see any sort of reaching in it.
See, I think he's showing up and he's hamming it up because that's what he's being asked to do.
And I see that now as you mention it.
I didn't like it when I watched this back in college. I remember finding him obvious and therefore unfunny.
Mm.
And I don't know what has changed because I am, to myself, notoriously allergic to camp. It doesn't work for me. It's one of my few things that I'm just sort of like, that is something that other people enjoy. And I found it interesting that, to me, the loudness and the self-aware of the loudness in his performance in this did work for me during this rewatch.
Hmm. Well, I'm very glad you enjoyed it.
But also, since I don't rank things, this is not going to affect...
No, I did rank it low, but I didn't dislike it. I just felt it, like I said, it was too what I expected.
All right. Well, in this next third of the program, my goal is going to be to get you to change that number slightly between what you've currently written down and when it comes time for you to state it in the episode.
We'll see.
I've never done this before.
Nope.
But I'm going to try.
I'm open to it.
Pete, the price is right, not bad.
No. As famous New Hampshire comedian Adam Sandler says in Happy Gilmore, the price is wrong.
The first major appearance of Vincent Price in the episode is after Hilda introduces him and after we zoom in on a matte painting with bad lightning effects, Fozzie and Gonzo are in a Transylvanian castle talking about how they didn't expect it to be quite this spooky, and Price knocks at the door and requests to be able to come in and find shelter for the night.
And that he has two people traveling with him, his beautiful assistant and a hideous monster.
And this is where the puppet known as Uncle Deadly, who I always thought was a Vincent Price homage. For example, when he shows up in the movie The Muppets, he's very much doing a Vincent Price.
Yeah.
And the fact that he's therefore created first appearance in all of Muppetdom in this episode as Vincent Price's lovely assistant, I think therefore he probably becomes more so as time goes by, but when he's acting next to Vincent Price, he's more just creepy and less doing an explicit Price impression here in his first appearance.
Yeah.
The third person that's traveling with them, the so-named Toto, never appears.
Correct.
It's just supposed to be a gag. It doesn't quite land.
I liked the reveal that
Harry is the beautiful assistant and the hideous monster is Toto.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that was fun.
That doesn't bother me. The reason it's named Toto, I assume, is a Wizard of Oz thing and Toto 2, except they never go in any direction where that would be funny.
Yeah, and then the reveal that at midnight, Vincent Price turns into a monster.
Right.
When you were just mentioning that you were traveling with a monster.
We move away from going anywhere with that potential joke of having the third person show up as a reveal of something never comes to fruition.
And that might be one of the reasons why I felt this sketch was so long. It's because
it goes in three different ways.
Yeah, you have the long intro, then you have just Fozzie and Gonzo, then intro of Vincent Price, then intro of Uncle Deadly, then monster, what time is it stuff, mm-hmm. and then the reveal of the monster. That's six different beats in a 3-minute sketch.
Yeah. But then it becomes all about the imminent transformation of when the clock strikes 12, something is going to happen. The lighting cue is very well done.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice subtle bit to, just with a floor lamp, create the opportunity that there is something that's going to happen. And then that light goes away when he ducks under his cape and comes back out. And then you get the weirdness of the final punchline.
Do you know that this was not the original punchline?
I didn't see what a lot of the internet commented, which that it was a very obvious bad dub.
I didn't even catch that.
No, to me, I didn't notice the mouth movements not syncing up.
Too cruel, too inhuman.
What is what? Tell, what?
On New Year's Eve, the master turns into Jack Parnell.
But in the original version as broadcast, the line was, and apparently on some early discs, you can find it as, "And the stroke of midnight, if he's transforming on New Year's Eve, he turns into Guy Lombardo."
Yep.
Do you know who Guy Lombardo is?
Nope.
Guy Lombardo was a band leader with...
Okay, so it's the same joke.
But in 1929, he did New Year's Eve broadcasts for years and is largely credited, including by the Encyclopedia Britannica, as the person who popularized using Auld Lang Syne as a New Year's theme in North America.
Interesting.
So it makes sense, therefore, for him to be the reference. However, it was determined that in an international audience, not enough people would know who Guy Lombardo was.
Case in point, me.
But also other countries, that Canada and America would know Guy Lombardo and the rest of the world wouldn't. So instead, they substituted...
Jack Parnell, the music leader of The Muppet Show.
So I think that's the reason why, but I delved deep into trying to figure out what was Jack Parnell's reputation, and did he have a connection with New Year's Eve? Not really.
No, but he was just a band leader.
He was
so
band,
it would make sense.
He wasn't just a band leader.
But
he was a famous band leader.
Right.
Parnell was a band leader for most of the 50s. transitioned in the early 70s as being specifically a television, ITV, ATV-based musician who worked on shows. But for most of the 70s, he and his band broadcast on Christmas Day. So they were associated with the end of the year. And he did the orchestrations for a 1966 Lena Horne album of Christmas songs, including an adaptation of What Are You Doing New Year's Eve?
So there's... Didn't we discuss on that episode that that's how they got her?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
That's not probably did we discuss it. That's, we think, probably that's how they got her. Yes.
Yeah.
To be clear. So I don't know if that decision could have actually been more... That's what I was trying to figure out. Would it actually have been a more successful reference that people in the 70s and 80s would have gotten? Or when it was redubbed in the 80s and 90s, was it just people being like, well, let's give props to the guy that made our show? Anyway, that was me delving into the weirdness of a specific joke way too much. But I enjoyed doing it.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. And yeah, that's the end of the sketch, too.
Yeah, so the end of the sketch is that Vincent Price as a vampire is blowing a party favor and wearing a hat in a subversion of how scary he would be.
My note is Vincent Price is Vincent Price in this sketch.
Which leads us to understand a little bit of why you didn't necessarily appreciate his performance, is that he's doing what is asked of him.
Yeah, but if he's a host on SNL and he is only being what we know of him, that is...
Not enough.
Yeah, that is considered a not successful hosting job. But in the panel discussion, he's himself. Like, he's not doing the spooky, creepy thing. And this is the thing I enjoyed the most.
I think he ends the panel discussion doing a hugely over-the-top, spooky, creepy thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's get to it.
Yeah.
The panel discussion, the topic of the day as we elevate the conversation around here is talking about gourmet dining, and Kermit is excited to point out that, as you mentioned in the trivia, Vincent is the gourmet cook who has produced several cookbooks, and since he has assembled the panel, Kermit wants him to be able to introduce. We have two guests. One is Pierre Lacourse, played by Nelson, who is a great chef, and Gorgon Heap is played by Hunt, who is a great eater. And Heap is a giant purple monster with fangs and a downturned banana nose, and Pierre is a whatnot Muppet in a chef's hat.
I very much enjoyed Gorgon Heap. And Gorgon's game is he's got a pitcher next to him, a cup next to him.
And a silver platter with something underneath it.
Yeah, and throughout the sketch, he just eats all of it. Every time the camera cuts back to him, he eats another item.
Whereas the rest of the game of the sketch is a conversation between Pierre and Vincent about great French cooking. And they throw in an enormous amount of incomprehensible French of very complicated dishes. When asked by Kermit what he thinks his favorite dish is, Vincent dithers for a little bit, but eventually produces that he thinks his most delicious dish is scallops de veau au l'estragon. And Pierre counters by saying that he prefers gigot et épaulet de près sole farci.
The captions on Disney Plus said incomprehensible French gibberish.
The captions on the DVD were accurate French.
Yeah, so I just figured this was Fudge McGurk level of them just saying, like, say some stuff that sounds like French.
No, these are actually, I mean, scallops and lamb and sauces. That's what's being described here.
Hmm.
They also specifically mentioned Vincent's counterpoint to Pierre's suggestion of doing lamb is he says the only way in which you can do that is if it's prepared in the precise manner that Escoffier prepared it. And in the subtitles, the trivia track says Escoffier was for a long time revered as the world's greatest chef. And the good joke about that is that, as you say, Gorgon Heap's been eating things. And when they mentioned the scallops, Gorgon says, oh, that is delicious. But when they mention Escoffier, he says, oh, he was delicious.
Oh, I didn't catch that. That's very funny.
And then goes on to say, oh, you'd be delicious about Kermit after having eaten Pierre.
Yeah.
But also, great escalation just in those lines. Like, that is a fantastic example of
heightening
right there.
Yep. and simple.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and as you said, eventually Pierre gets eaten, and then Gordon tries to eat Kermit at first, and then Vincent joins in and says, "You do look delicious," and seasons him before Gordon gets the final bite. As Kermit is trying to get out what next week's topic will be, we don't find out because he is eaten. Lastly, as you mentioned first,
yeah,
after Gordon eats Kermit, Vincent seems disappointed that he doesn't get to because he likes frog's legs, as disturbing as that may sound. Mm-hmm.
He says, "I'm a bit of a devil, but I do love frog's legs," and then runs his tongue around his mouth.
I wrote, "The very creepy, unsettling way he licks his lips at the end of the sketch was one of the more disturbing things I've ever seen in my life."
Whereas I laughed like crazy.
Oh, yeah. But out of horror is why I laughed.
Because it's doing a great job of being gross. He's taking the idea of being a horrific persona and he's turning it into just comic weirdness. I get that it's gross, but it's also him being an actor who's taking a huge comic risk. And I have an enormous amount of appreciation for a person who's like, there's a way of doing this that's subtle, there's a way of doing this that's creepy, and there's a way of doing this that is turned up to 11, and he goes to 12.
Yeah.
And the camera is just like, we're here for this.
Yeah.
We're not cutting for anything.
I'm a bit of a devil, but I do love frog's legs.
I think there's also crude laughter at this moment, too. But yeah, this is the most successful Vincent Price for me. This segment, this whole thing. Because, yeah, he's not being typical Vincent Price until this last moment where he is being Vincent Price.
Well, and even that is an escalation because the, "Well, Froggy, you do look delicious" thing is him morphing from "I'm talking about things that aren't associated with my persona" to "I'm reverting to persona." Mm-hmm. And then the final moment is "I am going to the moon with my persona."
And then the next time we see them is in the talk spot, mm-hmm. where he goes even harder into persona because he reveals to Kermit that he actually has vampire fangs.
And well, that he's able to manifest vampire fangs. Because Kermit asks him what you think would be a nonsensical question, saying, "In your films, you can turn into a vampire. How do you do that?" And instead of saying, "Well, it's makeup," he grows fangs instantaneously and then says, makes the claim, the outlandish, hilarious claim that this is because...
"That is perhaps the epitome of the actor's craft. You see, it takes tremendous concentration, years of physical and emotional training, and enormous mental exertion."
Which is just nonsense.
Yeah, but then Kermit immediately produces his own, and Vincent is jealous of the fact that Kermit can do it so quickly. And then Kermit bites his neck.
Mm-hmm. In thing that is well gift, if you're interested, you can find lots of Kermit attacking Vincent and Vincent. And again, it holds on Vincent's reaction. Vincent gets 4 moments that I can recall off the top of my head where the camera is just like, yeah, we're going to let him stretch out his reaction for as long as possible. I think they thought they had a real gem of him going over the top and they wanted to show that to us.
Also, after it's revealed that Vincent has fangs, we cut to an audience shot where the audience is monsters and they're acting like it's live at the Apollo. Like, they are freaking out that it is the best thing that they've ever seen is Vincent Price having fangs.
And I laughed at that. Uh-huh. Insert shot, too. It was such a great idea because, I mean, it does start off by Kermit saying, you know, our monster population is really pleased that you're here. So to then have a completely new audience shot, they don't have any of the puppets that are normally there in the same arrangement.
Yeah, there are a couple of normal puppets in the back background.
There's a pig in the second to last row that is not animated at all.
No, it's just
a
there.
Seat filler. Yeah. Whereas all the monsters are thrashing about, the pig is this immobile pink dot.
Yeah.
Anyway, my thesis is that Price is not doing just what is expected. He's actually going more than that. And that his reaction to being bit, his reaction to licking his lips, all of those are actually more. He's doing it, but he's doing it to grand heights.
Yeah, I see that.
Anyway, we'll get to your rating at the end, but that's my case.
Okay, it's valid.
The next moment of Vincent Price, as you say, is a wipe where he's backstage with his vampire costume.
Looking for Hilda.
And gives us all this in clunky expository dialogue.
But then Sweetums comes on stage and wants to give Vincent Price a hand. Mm-hmm. And so he gives him his hand. That's it.
Yep. The trivia track wants to point out that that's the hand that Richard Hunt doesn't use when he's moving Sweetum's mouth. Oh. That when you have the two arms of Sweetum when he's dancing or moving, that's the hand that he takes out of his arm in order to then manipulate the Sweetum's head. And so that hand is, in fact, useless when Sweetum's is talking, which is a neat bit.
It's fun. Then we have the You've Got a Fred segment, mm-hmm. the closing number. It starts off with Vincent by himself at a giant circular pipe organ, not playing it, and not singing well.
Well, miming playing it badly.
Yeah, and then singing poorly. And then I believe Uncle Deadly is the first one to join. Mm-hmm. But slowly but surely, as Vincent Price is singing about how he's such a great friend, more and more Monster Muppets come on the
set. They come out of the walls of the pipe organ and out of windows and out of all the nooks and shadows of the surrounding area.
Bats flood the stage. Ghosts flood the stage. The trash monsters are there as well. Just every monstrous creature that they've ever created comes on stage and they all sing together, and it is very good.
It does that additive thing that as they're talking about You've Got a Friend and more voices come in, it's genuinely emotionally effective mm-hmm. as a maximalist experience.
And his poor singing works better once the chorus is there. Mm-hmm. It is not as
strikingly untrained when he's got backup.
Yeah.
This is the scene that is the basis for the introduction cut in the opening number. And so if you watch this without being able to see this, if you watch this on the DVD, there's a momentary cut of Vincent wearing an astonishingly bad wig and garish costume surrounded by monsters that never comes back in the show. And it's very strange as, like, whatever happened to that?
Mm-hmm. There are examples where they use bits that aren't actually in the show with other
guests. Talked about the talk spot wall being a place where people get photographed.
Yeah.
But in general, it was the second time watching this, having not yet researched the fact that there was a number cut, I remember looking at that going, that's a lot of effort.
And he looks like Vincent Price, but he also doesn't look like Vincent Price.
Right. He looks bizarre. And that they would have put that much effort into a one shot that never comes back, because he's got his own normal hair and he's wearing dapper suits in most of his other appearances. But they went for the nines on this just for the intro shot?
Yeah.
I was glad to therefore discover what the heck was going on.
Yeah. I also liked the juxtaposition of the upbeat song with the spooky vibe of this set. That was enjoyable to me. It was good. Mm. I liked it. But it was still more Vincent Price being Vincent Price.
And again, I think it's a slight subversion, because the basic comic premise is that he's a terrible monster, but actually he's friends with all these monsters.
Yeah. And I do also, I guess I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth here, because this is the first themed episode. And I appreciate the fact that this is a spooky episode.
Right.
And so for the guest to therefore be a spooky guest makes sense.
As opposed to the Valerie Harper themed episode, where the theme is she wants to do something different than what she normally does.
Yeah.
The theme here is to do what he's notorious for.
I guess I kind of wish that they had switched these episodes. Mm. That Valerie Harper wanted to do something different and did a spooky episode, and Vincent Price did a high-concept cooking show would have been fun. So after this is the outro, where Kermit thanks Vincent and asks the audience to give him another hand, and Vincent says, "No, Kermit, let me give you one," and then does the same joke.
But it's a very good, realistic
adult man hand. Yes, however, what doesn't work is you, as he hands the hand to him, you see him immediately take his hand from outside his inside coat pocket. Like, that ruined it for me, too.
The fact that there were three hands on screen?
Yeah.
That's funny.
So, okay. I was thinking about the DVD cut.
Yeah.
You get Sweetum's hand.
It's bad.
You get Backstage 4, you get Talking Houses, you get
the hands joke, yep. It's way too close together in the DVD cut. It emphasizes just how little good Vincent Price there is with the absence of a great song in the middle.
Yeah.
And it makes those jokes fall hard upon each other.
Where this, even with the You've Got a Friend, it was still too close to me. Mm. So I guess there's now three chronological issues with this episode that I would have liked the Sweetums thing to be like right after the Spooky House.
Yeah. Also should have been after the Spooky House bit because that's the costume he's turning in.
Yep, that's true.
So chronologically...
Yes. Yes, we... Again, 45 years, we can make anything better.
That's the t-shirt, by the way. Mm. From our non-existent Redbubble store.
Yep, I like it.
All right, so that's it for the Vincent Price segments. So let's get into stats and whether or not I was able to influence your rankings.
So statistics-wise, out of the things we track, not a lot this episode.
Aside from eating.
Yep, there was one explosion in Wayne and Wanda, and then three characters got eaten as buttons. In terms of music, yep, Vincent Price, not a very musical guest except for that song. So 9 minutes and 12 seconds worth of music out of 26 minutes and 25 seconds of airtime on Disney Plus.
Correct.
So that is 34.86%, which is in the low zone, but not least.
Hmm.
We've had three episodes lower percentage-wise. You've Got a Friend was 2.67 minutes long. So, sure, taking that out. Yeah, so if you took that out, that's less than 7 minutes of music in a 21-minute episode then. So that's interesting. But yeah, not a lot stats-wise. So ranking... I put him at 21.
So bottom five in terms of amount of music and bottom five in terms of ranking.
So far, Harvey Korman is 24, Joel Grey is 23, Sandy Duncan is 20, and Charles Aznavour is 19. So
you liked him just slightly worse than Sandy Duncan. That actually tracks.
Yeah, that does track.
I can see you feeling that way.
Yeah. Those two may in final rankings... Yeah, I could see them switching, putting Sandy at 21 and him at 20, because, as we discussed in the Sandy episode, she does everything really well, but it just doesn't work, where
does
he
everything
works.
Actually, see, I think that's a good description of what you're doing. You think he does everything well, but very obvious, and so therefore it doesn't work.
Works more than hers.
His works
doesn't.
According to
his
what
character.
He should do, whereas you find a disconnect between what she's doing and what you think
yep.
she should be doing.
All right. You won. He's moving up to 20. So you moved him up, Ben.
I gave him the slightest of bumps.
Which means Sandy Duncan has now moved twice. She was originally 23. Mm-hmm. So she moved up
and then
a little bit
down. We end each episode, as we always do, by highlighting our five favorite moments of the show, concentrating on tiny bits of line reading or performance, highlighting details, not entire sketches, in order to focus on some good moments to leave you with and fond memories of the episode. I'm going to start with something I alluded to earlier in terms of subtitling.
Mm.
During the Muppet News Flash, one of the characters who is commenting on the fact that there aren't pieces of furniture turning into monsters is Sheriff David Goles.
Yep.
Named clearly after Dave Goles, the puppeteer famous for Gonzo.
Contacted for comment, Sheriff David Goles assured Muppet News Central that the rumor was false. According to Goles, there is no way for a piece of furniture to turn into a monster.
That's a great bit. It's a great little piece of inside baseball. The David makes it just formal enough that you don't notice it. The trivia track is eager to point out that this is a reference in case you don't walk around knowing who the names of the Muppeteers are. But the subtitle track puts it as David Coles, C-O-L-E-S.
So they won on French stuff and lost on the name.
So they know it's him in the trivia track, but don't know it's him in the actual subtitles, which I think is hilarious.
Very good. I agree. For my first moment, our second moment, in the first appearance of Thudge McGurk, after Statler jumps from the box, you get the cartoon sound of whistling.
Like a bomb falling.
Yeah. And you hear a crash. However, the whistling sound effect lasts after the crash. It is too long.
Hey, listen, on your way back up, bring some popcorn.
And so you hear the whee crash. Whee. And it brought me a lot of joy.
All right, so my first moment was a technical screw-up with the DVDs. Your first moment is a techno screw-up with the sound effects. I think it's only fitting for me, for my third moment, to point out a moment that doesn't quite work, but is elevated in its intention, which is during the Beatles number, during I'm Looking Through You, the third female ghost as played by Aaron Oscar is the one that fades in and out of existence. The others are on screen the whole time. Sometimes they'll go off to the sides and come back, but she has a really great technical thing with lighting against the blue screen. There's a bit where they zoom in on the backstage and the two Lennon and McCartney ghosts are singing on either side of a headless dress dummy. And then the female ghost comes out of the dummy, so her head is where the head would be on. And there's a V cut in her that matches the dress. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't quite work, but the intention is so good. Unfortunately, because the layering effect of the two ghosts on one screen and her on a different plate, it all makes the physicality of where they are on the stage not quite work in terms of a dimensionality. And it just looks like she's sort of fading up. But you can tell because of the V cut in the position what they were trying to do. And mm-hmm. I want to applaud them for coming up with a great visual concept that, given a little bit better technology a decade later, I'm sure would have been expertly done.
Yeah. For my final moment, I'm going to bring up Shaky Sanchez again. In the first backstage bit, right after he's been eaten and comes off stage, he walks backstage, Kermit's doing something, and Shaky's shaking, and Kermit looks at him and just tells him to
calm down back there.
And this man has just gone through trauma. Granted, they're acting, he wasn't really eaten, he's fine, but he's clearly shaken up.
Oh.
And Kermit wants him to calm down. He's not making any noise. He is purely shaking.
Kermit is a bad professional. Kermit is not looking out for the mental health of his employees. Kermit just wants things to be orderly and shipshape, unless he's forgotten about it, at which point he doesn't care.
So, Kermit being a bad stage manager is my final moment.
For my final moment of the show, I'm going to talk about the final moment of the show, which is having produced his fake hand to give to Kermit right before the closing credits. Then Uncle Deadly shows up to take the hand from Vincent Price, and as the credits roll up, Uncle Deadly uses the fake hand to wave goodbye to the audience. And it's a good bit.
Yep. And with that, let us wave goodbye to you, audience. This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design, such as it is, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. Theme song is from archival Henson Associates clips of Silver and Cones, Yes We Have No Bananas, under what we hope is transformative fair use, in which a YouTube video I watched today maybe backs us up on.
You can find us at farceperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at farstnamebasis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan Emily and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic phenomena.
There are things, dates, facts, names, gourmet French recipes, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect. Please contact us via the website, and we will post it to our errata page on farceperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete, my co-host is Ben. And we'll see you next time when we discuss production episode 21, guest starring Twiggy. Yay!